In what I believe is supposed to be the last class of this section of the year, we'll talk about just some of the high points of what we've covered over the second half of this. We are reviewing over the last couple weeks 14 weeks worth of material on the historical reliability of the Bible, and we covered the first half of it last time. We'll touch on some of the things from the second half tonight. Primarily focused on kind of the negative perspective, which is the critiques of the Gospels, the alleged historical errors, the alleged inconsistencies will take up the most of our time. But then we'll touch on the things like the manuscript issues that we talked a little bit about and wrap up with miracles and the resurrection, time permitting, and that's kind of where we're going this evening. But let's begin this evening with a word of prayer. Our Father, we're so thankful to you for this day that you've given us and for all the blessings that have come with it. We're thankful for this opportunity that we have now to study about your word and the confidence that we can have that it relays the truth concerning your Son to us. We ask that it would strengthen our faith in him and that by doing so it would strengthen our lives to follow after him and the example that he gave us. And it's in his name that we pray. Amen. All right. There's not a whole lot up here. I've just got a couple of lists from previous classes, so don't get too bogged down in looking at that. But starting with these alleged historical errors, what I think I want to try to do this evening, I've got several. I don't have the full listing of all of the things that we talked about in the past, but I've got several of the alleged historical errors, several of the alleged contradictions, and I think what I'd like to do is see how much you remember about those kinds of things, if anything, about how to solve those kinds of issues, and that may work better with the contradictions than the alleged historical errors if you don't remember all the details about that, but we'll give that a shot first and kind of see how it goes from there. But basically, over the course of a couple of classes, we looked at numerous alleged historical errors, places where critical scholars or skeptical scholars have suggested that there is an error of one kind or another in the Gospels. And we found that in a variety of cases, it wasn't the Gospels that were in error, but the skeptical scholars that were in a bunch of different kinds of perspectives. And so that's kind of the overview of what we talked about there. But let's look at a few examples of this. We'll start with an easy one. At least I think it should be an easy one. We've alluded to it several times over the course of this class, and I think I mentioned it just last week again as an example. So here's a softball to start with, and then we'll go from there. Mark chapter 7 and verse 31, speaking of Jesus here, it says, "He returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee in the region of the Decapolis." Now, I don't have a map on the screen tonight, but if the geography is not familiar to you just by seeing those names, you might check the back of your Bible for a map, or you could just listen to this brief description. Tyre and Sidon were up on the Mediterranean Sea, a little bit northwest of Canaan, as we might think of it proper. Tyre is to the south, Sidon is to the north. And then Galilee in the Decapolis is kind of east-southeast of that direction. And so the problem that is raised is that it doesn't make any sense whatsoever for Jesus to go north from Tyre to Sidon to turn around and then go back in this southeasterly kind of direction. One skeptical scholar in particular said, quote, "The evangelist was not directly acquainted with Palestine." And this is kind of their basic perspective. These Gospels weren't written by eyewitnesses. They were written decades or a couple generations later by people who were writing down these legends about Jesus. And typically, the view is they're not even writing in Palestine, but they're writing from a different country somewhere. And they betray this with all of this, all of these kinds of errors that they make. And here's one of them. Why would you go north in order to go south? That doesn't make a lot of sense. Greg?
Might not have been a shortest route, but it was the easiest route because there was a mountain range that had gone over. Instead, they went north and they came up past it.
Right, and that's the basic answer to this one is pretty obvious. There is somebody in this discussion that doesn't know the geography of Palestine and was not directly acquainted with it, and it's not Mark. It's the skeptical scholar who's saying that that's true of Mark, because there's this giant mountain right between Tyre and the Decapolis. If you go north, there's a nice little pass through the mountain with a river that runs all the way through, providing the water they need for the journey and everything else. On top of that, and I don't know how much we talked about this, but there is this other thing that's going on as well, which is that the Gospels are not intended to be exhaustive details of everything Jesus ever did. There may have been some other purpose that he went north. He may have had to stop to see somebody else along the way, and that's just not recorded. And so there are a couple of pretty obvious answers. One is that Mark's not designed to tell us everything Jesus did, and so there may have been something else very relevant to what he was doing, to why he went north. But even if that's not the case, nobody would have gone over this mountain when you could go a little bit to the north and go around it, and that was the typical journey that they made. So that's our first example. Again, that's kind of the easy one. We've talked about that a lot. All right, flip over to Mark 11. We'll look at a few examples in Mark first. Mark chapter 11 and verse 1. Jesus is here traveling from Jericho to Jerusalem. It says, when they drew near to Jerusalem, to Bethphage and Bethany at the Mount of Olives, Jesus sent two of his disciples and told them to go on into the village and so forth and so on. Here's the problem here. If you are going from Jericho to Jerusalem, you will get to Bethphage before you get to Bethany. But Mark lists them in the other order. He lists Bethany before Bethphage. And so it's the wrong order in your traveling direction from one to the other. And this same scholar, in fact, says Mark did not know the relative position of the two villages. He has them backwards. And what are your thoughts on that? Other than you're making a mountain out of a molehill? It'd be good to travel around that mountain, probably. Yeah, Greg?
Similar names, and maybe in translation, I'm trying to remember exactly.
I don't remember that there was a translation sort of thing going on with this one.
Two different towns, though, right?
Yeah, there are two different towns, Bethany and Bethphage.
There's so many potential. Nobody says Clearwater,
St. Right. Right, or Tampa St. Pete, or Minneapolis St. Paul, or Dallas Fort Worth. I think that's a pretty good thing to think about as well, is that maybe these villages were always listed in this kind of standard order. Now, I've not dug up all of the ancient resources to see how these villages are talked about. Part of the problem with that is these were tiny little villages that were about, I don't know, a couple hundred yards apart from each other. They're not making the news in any of the ancient writings. They're just not talked about that much. And so you're not going to find 500 examples of them being listed as Bethany and Bethphage in that order every time just because they're not making the press anywhere. Jonathan?
I think that just proves the text is a forgery because the real author of Mark, who is ignorant of the geography of Palestine, wouldn't have known about these two tiny
There you go. Something else going on here is Mark is—he's not giving a detailed itinerary here. He's not saying, and Jesus, traveling from Jericho, came to Bethphage, and then he came to Bethany, and then he came to Jerusalem. What he's doing is giving the approximate location of where Jesus was. It was at this basic region, the region of Bethany and Bethphage, which again, sounds a lot like kind of how you would say Dallas-Fort Worth or St. Pete Clearwater or whatever else. Along those lines. And he doesn't say he first came to Bethany and then came to Bethphage. He's just telling his readers roughly where Jesus was. And you've got these two villages that are just a few hundred yards apart. And it's just really not that big of a deal one way or the other here. Anything else on this one? Yeah, Brian?
And even if he did say he went to one before another, there could be a number of reasons why Jesus would do that anyway.
Right. That's a good point as well. It'd almost be like going north to go south. There may be other things going on than just it being in a certain kind of order. All right, flip back to chapter 10, which for some reason is out of order in my notes. Chapter 10 and verse 12 is what we're getting to, but start in verse 10 for the sake of context. Jesus here is talking about this issue of divorce. Actually, verse 11, he says, "Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her, and if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery." All right, so here the problem is that the Jewish law, the law of Moses, had no provision whatsoever for a woman divorcing her husband. It just was not on the radar of the Jewish people. So why is Jesus suddenly talking about what would happen if a woman divorced her husband? And the skeptical argument is this is further proof that this is being written much later by somebody who's kind of taking the idea and applying it to his own culture, because in Roman culture this would have been an issue, and so Mark is kind of massaging the teaching of Jesus. Jesus never actually would have said this about this kind of issue. Anyone remember what's going on here, Charlie? Yeah, this is one of those things where, again, the skeptical scholar is just showing that they don't know their history, because this is the same time and the same place, basically, that Herodias had just done this very thing. And in fact, when Josephus writes about Herodias divorcing her husband and to marry her brother-in-law, Josephus says that Herodias basically, you know, flew in the face of all of Jewish culture and Jewish law. That's not his exact words, but that's the basic idea. And so you have this very relevant example of this exact same thing happening at the same time and place. And that's when Jesus says this, to say, you know, this wouldn't have ever happened in Jewish culture, Jesus never would have talked about this, is to be ignorant of the very history you're saying that Mark is ignorant of. Yeah.
So that is recorded in the Gospels. And so even if they just read the Gospel themselves and be like, oh, well, Jesus must be talking about this person here, and calling her out again.
Right. All right. One that we won't take the time to turn to and read about, because you all know the story very well. Back in Matthew chapter 2, what is called sometimes the slaughter of the innocents. This is where Herod the Great says, I'm trying to track down this king of the Jews that the wise men never came back and told me where he was so I could kill him then. And so everyone in Bethlehem under 2 years of age, needs to be killed. But the problem here is this is never recorded in any other ancient history. And if this kind of terrible massacre of children had happened, surely it would have been written somewhere else. Therefore, Matthew's just making all of this up, or something along those lines. But it's basically never recorded anywhere else. Therefore, it couldn't have happened, is the way the argument goes. What's the problem here? Jonathan?
That's not how survival of ancient documents works.
Okay, so you've... Okay, so you've got several things going on here. First of all, just in general, arguments from silence are bad arguments, which is part of what's going on. Secondly, just because 2,000 years later we think something is big enough news that it should have been written down all over the place, doesn't mean that it would have happened. Third, you've got just the survival of the ancient documents at all. Which is very remarkable that we have as much as we do of anything from the ancient world. You're talking about thousands of years. It's very remarkable that we have as good of a picture in literature of the ancient world as we do. I was reading something, and I've never been able to track this down again, but basically it was saying that 90% of the documents from the second century based on ancient bibliographies are lost. And those are just the ones that we know about from ancient bibliographies. Who knows how many weren't ever written down on an ancient bibliography and are lost, and we don't even know that we don't... whatever I'm trying to say, that we don't have them. You're talking about just an innumerable amount of information that's just gone and will probably never be found again. So to say it was never recorded anywhere else says too much. It may have been recorded and just hasn't been found. Or, on the other hand, it may have never been recorded because it wasn't that significant. That's one of the things we talked about in relation to this. Anyone remember why this may have not been quite as significant as we tend to think of it as now? Stephen?
Bethlehem wasn't a very large
Yeah, Bethlehem's a village. It's a very small village, a few hundred people or how many people lived there. You take all the children 2 years of age and younger, and you're talking about maybe a half dozen kids. Now, that's not to say what Herod did to them was something you shrug your shoulders at. It's still terrible and deplorable and all of those things. But for a crazy, power-hungry, murderous king to kill a half dozen kids, that's just not going to be on the radar. I mean, that's kind of business as usual in the reign of Herod the Great. And so it's just not a remarkable event that's going to make the headlines anywhere. John?
Not just the number that was killed, but the fact that Herod was killing people all the time. So a few more people killed by Herod wasn't
right.
Unusual.
Yeah, you think of what's newsworthy, and typically it's what is non-standard behavior. That's why, as much as I don't like to watch the news because it's always a bunch of terrible stuff happening, it's pretty good that our news is a bunch of terrible stuff happening. I mean, you go some countries and what would be news would be a day without death, and that'd be fantastic news in some places. The fact that our culture and our country is such that it's peaceful enough across the board that people getting killed is what makes the news is a good thing overall. And so for, you know, Herod to kill people is not news. That's just what he does. I mean, that's a little bit of an exaggeration perhaps, but it's kind of the way things went.
To use a modern example, a shooting in San Bernardino, California makes the news. A shooting in Chicago doesn't.
Yeah.
One is considered routine, the other is not.
That's a fantastic example.
Another thing to note would be that the government would have a lot of control over that, over the propagation of information.
Yeah, and it's a small enough thing that this is the kind of thing Herod could have done in complete silence. It may have not been known outside of the people who were directly involved with it, maybe because Herod was suppressing it. Who knows exactly?
The fact that the slaughter was 2 years and younger may indicate that the Magi took 2 years to get there. And they didn't come to a manger, they came to a house.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I left out. But when we're talking about our contradictions, there's the apparent contradiction between them not having a place to stay in and them being in a house later on. And that one's solved pretty easily by the fact that a lot of time passes between the shepherds who come to visit Jesus and the Magi coming to visit Jesus. And, you know, you drive around the last, 3 weeks and you see all of them in the same place in people's front yards. But
Magi,
yeah,
with the creches.
Right.
They didn't get there.
Yeah, they wouldn't have been there at the manger, almost certainly.
Yes, also the children's place in society was a lot less than
yeah.
than now.
Yeah, like Tom was saying, I mean, half of them died before they hit five anyway. So it's, again, it's nothing you shrug your shoulders at. And, you know, the parents are heartbroken and all of those kinds of things. But it's just not it's not what we think of it as when we hear the slaughter of the innocents. I mean, what you're thinking about are just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kids, bloodbath and all of that kind of thing. And that's just not what happened. All right, a couple of examples from Luke. I'll run through them really quickly because I want to move on. The basic story with Luke is that there's a bunch of stuff that the skeptics thought were wrong, primarily due to silence, until Luke was shown to be right by archaeology. So, for example, in Luke chapter 3 and verse 1, there's a reference to Lysanias the Tetrarch, but there was a Lysanias who was a ruler in Chalcis half a century before that, and they thought Luke was wrong about that. In Luke chapter 3 and verse 2, reference to Annas and Caiaphas both being high priests at the same time. And everyone knows there's only one high priest in Jewish culture, not two. Therefore, Luke must be wrong. Luke chapter 7, reference to a synagogue in Capernaum, but there was no synagogue in Capernaum. It was too small of a town to have a synagogue in it. However, an inscription was found confirming that there was, in fact, a Lysanias who was a tetrarch in Abilene, like Luke said. Josephus wrote about two high priests being high priests at the same time some 2,000 years ago, and a synagogue was discovered in Capernaum and published about in 1983. And what's most significant about all of those examples is it shows how the skeptics either are ignorant of some of these things or they just recycle things without looking into the argument more fully, or they're being intentionally deceptive. And I don't know which of those things it is. I'd like to give them the benefit of doubt. But some 20 years after, no, it was, that's not, 20 years after the article was published about the synagogue in Capernaum, and that was in 1983. In 2003, a skeptical commentator was still saying that there was no Capernaum, no synagogue in Capernaum. Any time after Josephus that skeptics say that there couldn't have been two high priests at the same time shows that they're just recycling stuff without looking into it any further. The inscription concerning Lysanias, the Tetrarch of Abilene, has been discovered, and skeptics are still pointing out that alleged error after the fact. And so even when the weakness of the skeptical position regarding this historical's errors are shown to be false, they still keep cranking them out. And so the first thing that I'd say, if you're ever studying one of these Gospels and you find some alleged historical error in it, obviously don't sweat it is your first thing. Don't freak out about it. But then secondly, look at a couple of decent resources and find out if this has already been answered, because it's entirely possible that it has, like decades ago, and they're still just cranking out something that they're citing from an older critical source without investigating it anymore. So that's what we'll talk about as far as the alleged historical errors. Any questions, comments about those before we move on, though? All right, next we talked about contradictions. This is when two gospel passages seem to contradict with one another. And what we made a distinction between here are the distinction between something that is an actual contradiction, when there are two claims and one of them must be false if the other is true, one of them has to be wrong, and apparent contradictions, where it seems that they both cannot be true, but they can. Here's our first list of things that we talked about before. And these are the causes of apparent contradictions. Things like carelessness, where a scholar will interpret a phrase or a sentence without regard to the genre in which it is written or the narrative context in which the story is taking place. Completeness, which is to say that it assumes that every account includes every detail of that, and that's one that goes to the historical errors as well, like presuming Jesus couldn't have had any other reason whatsoever to go north. Conflation, where different events and people are treated as the same, or confusion, where the same ones are treated as different. And then also the cultural context, and this is a major problem, where we just ignore facts about the language, facts about the culture, facts about all kinds of things in the original context, and assume that they are writing in, you know, 21st century Western historical method, or some kind of scientific precision, which just wouldn't have been the case from back then. So those are the kinds of things we talked about as far as that goes. Now, a few examples of this. In Luke 7 and Matthew 8, we won't take the time to look at those in particular. This is when the centurion wants his servant healed. And in Luke, I believe, it says the centurion came to Jesus to ask for his servant to be healed. And in Matthew, it says that he sent the elders to ask if Jesus could heal the servant. So what is our... obviously, the apparent contradiction is one says the servant did it and one says that he sent other people to do it, and both of those things can't be true at the same time. But what did we say about that in particular? Yeah, Jonathan?
Again, that's just not how language works. We talk all the time about things that the president does. The president didn't personally do.
Okay.
You know, the president makes a statement. Well, actually, there's a press secretary who made the statement. But it's coming from him. It's his message. We can, you know, run off countless examples of how people talk.
Okay.
And so there's no reason why one of the gospel authors couldn't talk or the centurion sending word to Jesus without mentioning specifically that it wasn't actually him personally, but these other people, and yet still have it be perfectly a legitimate way of expressing what happened that we would use today.
Yeah, and like you say, there are countless examples of that. And in particular, when someone is in a position of authority and they're delegating under their authority, this person to do this in my name. Everyone understands exactly how that works. Charlie?
That's not to say he didn't send both. I mean, sometimes, you and I have done it. Be like, hey, can you tell somebody so-and-so? And then 5 minutes later, tell somebody else.
Okay. Or he could have, followed up himself. A fantastic example of this is in the exact same text of how this language works, and nobody ever bats an eye at this, but as the elders, they're actually in Luke's account as the elders coming to Jesus, they plead with Jesus earnestly. This is Luke 7 and verse 4. They plead with him earnestly, saying, "He is worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our nation, and he is the one who built us our synagogue." Now, what commentator in the world has interpreted that to mean that the centurion himself, with his own hands, he and he alone, built the synagogue? No, nobody thinks it means that he built the synagogue. It means that he's the person who is behind the building of the synagogue. He raised the funds, he drew the blueprints, whatever it may be in specific. He was the driving force for having this done, but he may have never broken a sweat as far as building the synagogue goes, yet that's exactly what they say. And the same thing is going on here. When Matthew says that the centurion asked Jesus, that's like the elders saying the centurion built the synagogue. And it's just this kind of authority and delegation of what's going on here. All right, Matthew chapter 27 and Acts chapter 1, this is the death of Judas. Matthew says that Judas hung himself. Acts, we read, Luke tells us that he fell and burst open. What's our solution to this?
Well, the rope must have broke.
Okay, so a very sensible one. If Judas hung himself from a high place and he was left out there for a while, eventually the rope breaks and his body falls, and with the swelling and the decomposition, not to get too graphically gross, it doesn't have a pleasant ending when he hits the rocks below. We'll leave it at that. Charlie?
Or he doesn't, he goes to hang himself, the rope snaps, technically hangs himself because he gets the jerky motion, falls out, hits a rock.
Okay, so he tried to hang himself, but I hadn't thought about it in that way, but I mean, that's a plausible reconstruction as well. Yeah, it's one of those things that it's just, you look at this and you presume, well, these say different things, therefore they must be in contradiction with one another. And that's just not what contradictions are. And you could probably think of any number of things in your life that have gone on and say, you describe it in different ways at different times, that it's exactly the same story. You're emphasizing one aspect over a different aspect of it because of, what the situation demands as to how you tell the story, or what you remember that time you tell the story, or whatever the case may be, and yet they're not in contradiction with each other. I mean, you think about, an auto accident you've been in. I presume most people have been in it, been in at least one auto accident at some point in their life, and you describe that five different times in five different years, and one time you may hydroplane, another time you may get in a head-on collision. Which of those is true? Well, one led to the other, in whatever case it may be, or all of those different kinds of things as to how this all works out. It's just not contradiction because it looks like one on the surface. Another example we talked about, and I don't want to get too bogged down on this one, but this is one that comes up from time to time, and this is when was Jesus crucified? Was he crucified on the Passover day itself, or the day before the Passover, the preparation for the Passover? And this is just an example of scholars either ignoring or not knowing something about just how the language worked. And that is, the word preparation itself doesn't mean preparation for the Passover. It's the preparation of the Passover, which is the Passover's preparation day, which sounds a lot like preparation for the Passover. But the word preparation always means, when it comes to a day of the week, always means Friday. It was the preparation for the Sabbath is what it was. In fact, the Greek word for Friday is the word preparation, which shows how far-reaching Jewish influence was in Greek culture. That's it came to be that in the Greek language. But everywhere preparation is used, all over other ancient Jewish literature as well, preparation just means Friday. And so the Passover that year was on Friday, but it was also a preparation because it was Friday. So it's just an example of not understanding or ignoring that preparation means Friday. So it wasn't the preparation for the Passover, it was Passover Friday, like, you know, we might say Easter Sunday in our language today. So that's what's going on there. All right, one other example that we'll talk about in the resurrection account. All four of them mention something different about the people the women see when they get there. They also mention different things about how many women were there, but we'll leave that one aside today. One of them says they saw one man. One says they saw one angel. One says they saw two men. And the other one says they saw two angels. So which was it? Did they see one man, two men, one angel, or two angels? Hopelessly contradictory. Yes. Okay. So let's start with the one versus two. How do we reconcile one or two? I mean, obviously one and two are not the same number. So there's at least an apparent contradiction there. Jonathan?
If they saw two, but only one spoke, then only one was relevant.
Okay.
Okay.
Example I gave of this kind of thing, if I run into an old friend from Florida College out in town somewhere, just bump into him, and he has his wife with him, but his wife is someone I've never met because they got married much later on, and I just don't know her, and she doesn't even really talk in the conversation. I get home, I may say to my wife later, hey, I ran into Bob or whoever today when I was at the store. And we talk about that for a while, never mention the wife. And then later, I say something about seeing Bob and Sue together. Now, I've told two conflicting stories about that one encounter. Which one of those is accurate? Well, in one of them, I just mentioned the one person who was really relevant because he's the one person that both of us know and actually did something. And later, I kind of fill in the other detail about what's going on. Or maybe he runs into her and says, yeah, my wife and I saw your husband at the store today. I don't think she'd say, well, he lied to me. He only said you were there. We understand exactly how this kind of thing works. And that's probably the sort of thing that's going on with the one versus two. Only one of them apparently was speaking, and so he's the one that needed to be mentioned. And so two of the Gospels don't see fit to mention both of the angels, just the one who did the talking. The others fill in the detail that there were actually two of them there. Now, two of the Gospels say they were men, two of the Gospels say they were angels. What's going on here? Jonathan?
Angels are repeatedly characterized as looking like men.
Okay. Charlie?
Genesis 20:21.
Okay. Yeah, so you've got Abraham, you know, sitting by the tree, and three men show up, and two of them, who are later specifically identified as angels, go down to Sodom to investigate what's going on there, and the people say, bring out the men that came down to you. Author of Hebrews talks about people entertaining angels unaware. It's like, I mean, how did you miss those giant wings and that glowing halo that you didn't know that this was an angel you were entertaining? Well, it's because at least a lot of times, angels look like people. And that's all they look like. And this kind of, you know, pop culture idea of what an angel looks like is just really not that biblically supported at all. And so what's going on probably is that two of the Gospels are reporting what they saw, and two of the Gospels are interpreting what they saw. So two of them say they saw men, and two of them tell us what those men actually were, rather than just reporting what they looked like. And so again, it might look superficially like there's a contradiction here, but there's no real contradiction to be concerned about. All right, anything else along these lines? All right, again, we talked about just lots and lots of examples of that, and I don't want to get too bogged down on all of that in a review class. We'll move on from these kind of negative attacks against the Bible and talk about the issue of the manuscripts of the New Testament and textual criticism. And what that relates to is the fact that we don't have any original documents. of the Gospels or any of the Bible. All we have is copies, and really they are copies of copies of copies that we have that are at this point. And so how do we know that over the course of time the documents have not been just filled with errors so that we can't recognize them anymore? And the example that is constantly given by every skeptic is the telephone game, where we play the game and we pass around the saying all the way around the room, and it comes back, and then it's completely butchered at the end. And that's what manuscript translation must have been, or transmission must have been like. And of course, we said that's a lousy illustration, because the point of that game is inaccuracy. It's done in such a way to ensure inaccuracy, which is not at all what's going on with scribes copying things down. And so it's a flawed analogy to begin with. But then going beyond that to just the data itself is really the best place to hang your hat. There are more than 5,800 Greek manuscripts. The oldest of those date to within 100 years to within 50 years of the original writing. Those are mostly fragmentary. Those are completely fragmentary, I should say, those oldest ones. Most of the significant ones, including complete New Testaments, date between that earliest 40 up to about 300 years from the original. So that's your basic Greek manuscript data, 5,800 copies, oldest going back between 40 and 300 years after the original. In addition to that, there's some 30,000 manuscripts of ancient translations from the 2nd to the 5th centuries. And if we lost all the Greek manuscripts, we could recreate the entire New Testament just from those translations. And on top of that, there are more than a million manuscripts of patristic quotations, these early church writers from the 2nd to the 5th centuries. And if we lost all the Greek manuscripts and all of the translations, there are enough quotations in these writers that we could recreate the entire New Testament just from the multiplicity of quotations in their letters and sermons and the like. And you compare this to every other ancient document, there is no other document that's even remotely close to this amount of manuscript evidence or is so close to the time of the original writings. You go back to them, the Iliad's about as good as you get in terms of numbers of manuscripts. There's about 1,700 manuscripts of the Iliad, which just pales in comparison to 5,800 New Testament manuscripts. Tacitus, there's two manuscript copies. And really, it's only one, because each of those two is recording a different part of Tacitus. So it's kind of part A and part B. So there's really only one total, one of each. I'm trying to remember if it's not Tacitus. I think it's one of Josephus's. That's about as good as you get in terms of time. It's about 500 years removed from the original. As far as the manuscripts of ancient translations, there's no other ancient document that has even remotely close to the amount of translation evidence that the New Testament has. Most of them don't have any translation evidence. As far as the quotations go, no other ancient document has that kind of quotation evidence from other early sources. And in terms of a conclusion about this, no other ancient document's veracity is ever questioned. People don't say, oh, I'm just not sure I have the original Iliad. They just don't worry about that. And when all of the other ancient documents are so much worse than the New Testament, why is the New Testament the only one that's even remotely ever questioned? So just the data of the manuscripts itself should be sufficient to really solve any concerns. But beyond that, there are also errors in the manuscripts. You don't have any two manuscripts that agree with each other identically, except in the smallest fragments. So there are thousands of errors. Well, two things about that. First of all, as we said, that's a problem of wealth. The only reason there are thousands of errors is because there are thousands of manuscripts. You don't have thousands of errors in Tacitus because there's only one copy of each half. And so there's nothing to compare it to know if it's an error or not. The whole thing could be an error and no one would know because there's no other copies. So this is a problem of wealth, first of all. But then as you look at the errors, what you find is that, first of all, understanding the kinds of errors that are made, that answers a lot of the question and removes a lot of the difficulties. The vast majority are spelling errors, and it's no problem at all because you know exactly what it's supposed to say. Very few actually change the meaning of the sentence, and no Christian doctrine hinges on a disputed reading. If all the errors in manuscripts that actually change the meaning of a sentence, if you decided I'm never going to read that verse again because I just can't be confident that I have what this author actually wrote, if you never read those again, nothing you believe as a Christian would change. Because everything that's talked about in those passages are taught somewhere else, all of the variants included. So it's just not that big of a deal. Now, as to reconstructing it, we talked about textual criticism and the way this is done, and we don't need to get bogged down on all of this again, but I wanted to at least acquaint you with what textual critics do with these manuscripts. And we actually did a little textual criticism exercise, if you remember that, where you got some botched up copies of a passage in Nehemiah and were able to recreate what Nehemiah said from five or six completely wrong versions. And you can kind of see how it works. But basically, this is it. Shorter readings are preferred. Harder readings are preferred. Earlier is better. Wider geographic distribution is better. Context is preferred. And all of this is rooted in what we talked about in terms of tendencies of the scribes and tendencies of the authors. If you understand the kinds of mistakes scribes made, then when you look at two manuscripts, you can figure out which one is wrong because one of them is going to look like the kind of mistake a scribe made. If you understand the way authors wrote, and one of those manuscripts doesn't look like what the author said, then you have a pretty good idea of what's going on because it doesn't match what the author said. So if you understand the tendencies, these are the principles that kind of come out of those tendencies and the way textual critics do their thing. And again, I don't want to get too bogged down on that. Well, wrapping up then in our last couple minutes, with miracles and the resurrection, as far as miracles themselves go, what we talked about in relation to that, first of all, is that the idea that miracles are a legendary embellishment of the story just doesn't work because the miracles are vital to the narrative. It's not like you can take the miracles out of the story and they make any sense whatsoever. And we gave a variety of examples of that, how they're interwoven in the narrative in such a way that it's what the narrative is all about in those places. I mean, unless you take out entire sections of the text, you can't just pull them out and say they're legendary development later on. On top of that, the kind of historical evidence that you look for, you find in the miracle stories. Multiple attestation, lots of people talking about this. Dissimilarity, which is that the miracles Jesus did wouldn't match, or they don't match other miracle stories that are clearly legendary. Jesus doesn't do the kinds of things other supposed miracle workers did. So if it's legendary embellishment, why doesn't he do the same kinds of things all the other miracle people did and the other fiction and the other legends and the other mythologies? The criterion of embarrassment, that there are things in the miracle stories the gospel authors wouldn't have recorded if they're just making stuff up because it makes Jesus look bad, it makes them look bad, and on we could go. And then the fact that these were never denied by the opponents of Jesus. Not only in the Bible, where they acknowledge Jesus does the miracles, but after the Bible is as well, other documents where people are trying to heal in the name of Jesus. And the Talmud, the Jewish writings, says it's better to die than to be healed in the name of Jesus. And you have all of these references later on outside the Bible that seem to indicate everybody back then believed Jesus was doing miracles, whether or not they liked Jesus or were supportive of him. And so that's even more attestation to Jesus having actually done this. And really the only reason that anyone would question the miracles is if they are a naturalist that says only things in nature can explain what's going on at any point. This methodological naturalism that we've talked about before. But really, that's just kind of ethnocentrism. It's presuming that 21st century Western scientific method is the best way of looking at things and everyone else is an idiot, is basically what it boils down to. It's ignoring the vast majority of the population throughout the entire history of the world to say anyone that believes in miracles is, you know, small-minded. On top of that, it's self-defeating. Science is based on what could be repeatedly observed. Except singularities. Well, singularities have to be understood in terms of regularities, but that's not what goes on. I mean, regularities very often point away from, or these singularities often point away from naturalism. The the tendency toward disorder, yet naturalism says it started with disorder and all became ordered. Where does information come from? Well, it comes from intelligence, except when it's in DNA. And on we could go. It flies in the face of it. And we talked about several things there. Finally, then, the resurrection. And again, what we did as we talked about the resurrection, we've talked about the resurrection plenty of times, and so we're just about out of time. That's all right. We've talked about this a lot. Basically, we looked at four theories, that it was myths, that the followers of Jesus never claimed that he rose again, that it was a hallucination or something along those lines, where they were deceived into thinking he was rose again. It was a conspiracy, which is they deceived others into thinking that he rose again, or the basic premise of Christianity, that he did, in fact, rise again. And we talked about five things as it related to that: the appearances of Jesus, the low status of women, as the fact that they first saw Jesus as a clear picture of the historical reliability of the accounts, the immediate proclamation in Jerusalem, the very place where Jesus died, they're making this claim, the voluntary suffering of the disciples, and the worldview change of people like Paul and James. And then the empty tomb, which is one of the key pieces of circumstantial evidence that they're preaching Jesus rose from the dead in the very city that he was buried. And while the empty tomb itself doesn't prove the resurrection, it's a very important piece of evidence because, if the tomb wasn't empty, then he wasn't raised from the dead. And then worked into all of that are the five key minimal facts, the things that basically all scholars, whether they're believers or not, agree with, which are that Jesus died by crucifixion, his followers believed that he appeared to them, the conversion of Paul, the conversion of James, and the empty tomb. And just those five things alone, you can make a pretty compelling case for the resurrection. That by itself is more evidence than a lot of ancient history has behind it. And then you add in everything else you could think about, and it becomes just overwhelming. The only reason you would think that Jesus couldn't have been risen from the dead is if you start with this hidden premise of methodological naturalism, which is there is no God. And they typically don't say that that's the premise they're beginning with, but that is the premise they're beginning with, that there's not a God. You start with that premise. Well, yeah, obviously no one can be raised from the dead. Obviously miracles can't happen if there is no God. But if there is a God, what's surprising about miracles? What's surprising about resurrection if there's a God? And so beginning to end, as we've looked through the Gospels, over and over and over, they pass the test in terms of the historical reliability of the accounts. You can look at these documents and trust what they have to say. Trust that you have an accurate picture of Jesus and his followers and what he said and what they said and what they did. And that ultimately, he did in fact rise from the dead. All right, any last questions or comments? Yes, sir, Brother Winton.
You don't want to get into Psalms 2:12.
No, probably not. And when I'm already 3 minutes over,
yeah,
so
well, I don't think.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for your attention through the last few months and comments. I've enjoyed the study. I hope you have as well.